Good. We're going to think about Lamentations 3, if you want to keep that open in front of you. I mentioned earlier that already our attention is drawn to Lamentations 3 because it is the central chapter. Our antennae should pick that up because of the way Hebrew poetry often works. We've already noted it's a triple acrostic, so all the effort he's already made with the other chapters, he intensifies that pattern for this chapter. The only other part of the Bible as intricately crafted as Lamentations 3 is Psalm 119. We're in some of the most exquisitely composed parts of God's Word. It is actually the same length in terms of content. It's three times the number of Bible verses for us because we've given a verse to each line rather than a verse to each stanza. But the effect of that is that actually each line is punchy. There's lots of punchy, quick, fast statements in this particular poem. It gives it a more urgent pace than the previous two chapters. Another significant difference is the voice that we're listening to. In chapter one, we had the writer observing and describing what had befallen Jerusalem, talking about them, and occasionally giving Jerusalem an opportunity to respond as a personified lady talking about her experience. But in chapter 3, verse 1, we now have an individual voice. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. We are now listening to one man's lament. This man and what he has experienced. Some people have said maybe this is Jeremiah. Certainly there's lots of connection between some of what Jeremiah went through and what this individual describes. Some have said, well, maybe it's Jerusalem personified. But I think we have to treat this voice as belonging to a real individual. And it makes sense that the person who has been observing and narrating up until this point now steps forward and gives his own testimony of what he's been through. And so rather than him being the observer and Jerusalem being the subject, we are the observers and he is the subject. And it reminds us, as one of the commentators has put it, that suffering is always personal. So the effect of this chapter is a little bit like the effect of during the Syrian refugee crisis. Do you remember the difference it made when that picture of the little boy washed up on the beach was suddenly published online and shared? Suddenly that changed public opinion and government policy, because we went from kind of abstract, broad brush strokes to an individual, and suddenly it brought it home. And we suddenly could realise and empathise, because we were dealing with a life. And there's something of that effect, I think, in Lamentations 3. As we listen to this one voice, we can begin to extrapolate from his experience to that of the countless others who would have gone through similar things to him. And so this voice is, in one sense, representative. He is giving voice to what would have been typical of many of his fellow Israelites. He speaks for them, but he also speaks to them. He's a prophet as well as a poet, hence people thinking it could be Jeremiah. He speaks from inside the experience himself, but is still able to address his community and to have some kind of leadership and guidance for them. But the poet is anonymous, and we respect that and honour that. As we go through chapter 3, a lot of that historical detail is stripped out. The language is very vivid, as we will see, but lots of the specific details that link it in to the particular history of Jerusalem are not there. And so it feels a bit more generic. And so I wonder if the effect, again, is meant to be parallel to in James 1 when he says, consider it pure joy when you experience trials of many kinds. He doesn't name the trials, because the moment he names it, we excuse ourselves from it if it's not our particular trial. And I wonder if the language of Lamentations 3 is deliberately generic so that it can be easily appropriated by other people. It's been given to us as language that we can take up if we ever go through this kind of experience. We can identify with it. A couple of other things just to notice by way of introduction. At the centre of this chapter, we have words of affirmation and hope. We heard some of them as we had the passage read, verses 22 to 24, talking about the steadfast love of the Lord, his mercies being new every morning. And then verses 31 to 33, he will have compassion, again, the abundance of his steadfast love. And so the central words of the central song of the whole book are words of hope. And that is, I take it, significant. They become, if you like, the centerpiece. They are the focus. But interestingly, those words of hope are not the final note at the end of the book. We move from these words of hope into further deep lament. And so I think it's telling that we have, in the book of Lamentations, we literally have hope in the midst of pain. Not hope at the end of pain, but hope slap bang in the middle of pain. And we're reminded that Paul tells us to rejoice in our sufferings, in their midst, in the thick of going through them. And so that the movement of Lamentations isn't lament to hope. We've stopped lamenting now and now we're hoping. It's rather the presence of hope in the middle of lament, literally in the middle. Verse 39 says, why should a man complain, a man, about the punishment of his sins? And a lot of people take that to be a kind of ending the section that began with, again, the man in verse 1. And so we're going to focus on this first half of this poem for our time in this session. And you'll see from the handout, we're going to think about hope having been extinguished, hope being recovered, and hope being applied. So firstly, hope extinguished, and we're in the first 18 verses of Lamentations chapter 3. The voice begins right where we left off. Verse 1, I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. And we presume that the his wrath refers to the wrath of God. We've just been hearing about the wrath of God in the previous two chapters. But interestingly, God isn't named until verse 18. He is the subject of all the verbs in these verses. He is the main character, but he's kind of formally unnamed throughout, but we know it is God that is being spoken of. So let me take us through some of these verses. I am the man who has seen affliction under the rod of his wrath. Do you remember in Psalm 23? Your rod and staff comfort me. Now the rod afflicts. He is under the rod, not of direction and care, but a rod of wrath. The shepherd is attacking the sheep. The shepherd who David could say, he leads me beside still waters. This man now says in verse 2, he has driven and brought me into darkness without any light. Surely against me he turns his hand again and again the whole day long. Verse 4, he has made my flesh and my skin waste away. He has broken my bones, flesh, skin, bones, the whole person. This is comprehensive punishment. Verse 7, he has walled me about so that I cannot escape. This man feels imprisoned. He has made my chains heavy. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. It's as if the walls are so thick that his voice can't be heard. I'm staying with a couple I know from my old church who live up in Leeds, and found myself in the situation this morning of not being able to get out of my bedroom. Something funny had happened with the door. I'd pushed it closed after having had my shower, and then I couldn't open it. And so I was thinking, I don't know their phone numbers. And I know they're downstairs, but I was knocking on the door and calling out. And it was some time before they came in and said, actually, yeah, the door does this. Thanks for telling me. And he said, if you just stand back, I will barge through it from the outside. And he released me. I could have been stuck there all day. You never know. But here, someone is locked in, and though they call and cry for help, no one can hear. At this stage, God is not willing to listen to this man's prayers. His prayers are being hindered. We see that in the New Testament sometimes as a discipline. In 1 Peter 3, if we husbands do not care for your wives, unless your prayers are hindered, is a threat. Sometimes God will not hear our prayers. And whereas in the book of Proverbs, the straight paths lead to life, the crooked paths lead to death. And so in verse 9, he has blocked my ways with blocks of stones. He has made my paths crooked. He's very happy to mix his metaphors. He's chained up and boxed in, but he's also walking along crooked and blocked paths. Now, again, we are used to God being the shepherd, and one of the most important roles of the shepherd in the ancient world was to protect the sheep from fierce animals. But now in verse 10, God is the attacking animal. He is a bear lying in wait for me. A lion in hiding. He turned aside my steps and tore me to pieces. He has made me desolate. I don't know if you've been watching the new Planet Earth series. Amazing shows to watch. I mean, so much beauty, and yet they're pretty unpleasant as well. I've never shouted for an iguana to run faster in my life than I did a couple of weeks ago. I was watching it with a couple from church, and the wife said, I don't know if I want to watch this. I hate these shows because I can't bear it when the lion kills the gazebo. Suspect she meant gazelle, but they can be very, very, very gruesome. You do see animals being torn to pieces. That happens. And that is the kind of experience this man is describing. And it's God who's done that. It's not a nasty animal. It's God himself tearing limb from limb. In verse 12, he switches image to God being an archer doing some target practice. He bent his bow and set me as a target for his arrow. So you can imagine God there with the equivalent of a sniper rifle looking through the targeting lens of it and getting this man in his crosshairs and just firing at him again and again, thinking, did I get a bullseye this time? How close was I? And this man is utterly helpless. He's just a target. He's just fodder for the beast. I don't know if you remember the first Terminator movie, but one of the things that made that movie so effective was this portrayal of the Terminator as being someone who will never, ever, ever stop going after you until he's ended you. Can't reason with it. As long as it has the ability to do so, it will hunt you. And something of that is this man's experience. He just can feel God setting traps for him, God targeting him, God relentlessly pursuing him. Well, in verse 13, the archer hits his target. He drove into my kidneys the arrows of his quiver. In Hebrew, thinking kidney is where your joy and your grief come from. There, the arrow equivalent of the would be the heart. And he then describes being ridiculed. I've become the laughing stock of all peoples, the object of their taunts all day long. He's filled me with bitterness. He's sated me with wormwood. Wormwood was a very bitter herb used in medicine. And this man is now being made to feed on it. That's bitter, sour taste in his mouth, sating him with bitterness. The sobering and undeniable message of these verses is that it is all too possible to encounter God as an enemy. And again, it raises the question, do we believe that? Do we believe in a God who can be an enemy? And in case we're tempted to think that's just an Old Testament thing, James 4 reminds us that friendship with the world is enmity with God. We provoke God into this kind of enmity when we side with the values of a world that has rejected him. James isn't talking about having friends within the world, he's talking about being friends with the world, with its attitude. Well, this man begins to draw some conclusions. Verse 16, he has made my teeth grind on gravel. And the language is so vivid, I can feel that. I can feel my teeth tingling with the thought of that. He made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I've forgotten what happiness is. He had once known peace and happiness. But now those things are long gone. I've forgotten them. I can't remember how that felt. I can't remember what it felt like to wake up and have joy at the prospect of the day that lay before me. And so he sums it up in verse 18. And so I say, my endurance has perished. So has my hope from the Lord. You can imagine someone in that situation would say it out loud. I have no hope from God. I have no endurance. I have nothing to keep me going. Nothing to keep going for. And it is all the more desperate because God is the one who's done this. If you're in bad circumstances, you always have the hope, well, maybe God will help. Maybe he will intervene. But if God is the one who is doing it, you have nowhere to turn. You have no reason to endure, no light, even hypothetical light, at the end of the tunnel. If God is encountered as an enemy, there is no hope anywhere. For what can you hope in if God is your enemy? Putting it another way, if God is against you, who can be for you? And so he says, my hope has perished. It is gone. Precisely the one thing we need to endure suffering, even horrific suffering, is entirely unavailable. But not quite. Verse 19, something remarkable happens. He says, remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. He's addressing us as readers. We've got to remember this experience that he's going through. He says, my soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Verse 21. It's amazing. He can say within the space of two or three verses, my hope has gone, and yet now I have hope. And the reason isn't because his circumstances have changed. It's not because his situation is any different. The reason is simply because in verse 21, there is something that has come to mind. And that something means he can have hope in the face of an utterly hopeless situation. And so he tells us what it is that he's called to mind and why it is he has hope. And so we have hope recovered, verses 19 to 39. And we move on to verses 22 to 24, and this is the famous bit. If anyone knows any bit of Lamentations, this is the bit they know. In fact, if people know nothing of Lamentations, they still know this bit because of the hymn we sang earlier, "Great is thy faithfulness, morning by morning." Or we think of the other hymn, "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases." And most of us will sing hymns like that, sort of forgetting the desperate context in which those truths are affirmed in the Book of Lamentations. You can't just dive into Lamentations 3 verse 22. You've got to eat your vegetables. Well, what is it that gives him hope? He remembers the steadfast love of the Lord. He remembers his mercy. He remembers his faithfulness. Verse 22, depending on your translation, shows it's because of the Lord's steadfast love that he is not cut off. So here is something that gives him hope. Life itself, even in desperate misery, is a sign of God's grace. I'm not cut off. He is hugely afflicted beyond what many of us will begin to imagine. But he can say, I'm still here. I've not been entirely consumed. I'm still around. And just that fact shows me something. Barry Webb writes, "Hope is reborn with the realization that even to be able to lament is a gift." Isn't that something? The fact you can lament, the fact that you have air in your lungs to give voice to your grief is a gift. Barry Webb continues, "For to weep is to be alive, and to that extent, at least, an object of divine grace. In the worst of any situations, it is a sign of divine grace that we are still alive. That in itself is undeserved." But of course, as he reflects on God's love, on God's compassion and God's faithfulness, it rings bells in his mind. Bells from Exodus 34, where again we've been told, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness." Compassion, love, faithfulness. He remembers that God is the God of the covenant. He remembers that this God who is an archer, this God who is a bear, this God who is a lion, this God who is the jailer, the sniper, the consumer and the destroyer, is also the God who makes and keeps promises. And moreover, that activity of God in making covenants is not incidental. It's not God's kind of side hobby. You know, you've got your "what do you do" type question, then we've got the "what do you do in your spare time" type question, don't we? The covenant making activity of God belongs to the centrality of what he does. It's not his kind of Saturday morning hobby in the garage kind of thing. It's defining of who he is, a God of covenant faithfulness. It's one of the most fundamental things we can know about God, is that he makes and keeps covenants. And he's made a covenant to his people. He's pledged himself to the people of Israel. He did so first in his covenant to Abraham. He renewed it with Isaac and Jacob. He renewed it again with Moses and with Joshua. People have been reminded again and again that he is their covenant God. And that is what the poet calls to mind. God is the God of these things. He is the God of steadfast love, of mercy, of compassion, of faithfulness. And notice, by the way, in the midst of this awful litany of despair and pain and of divine punishment, almost subconsciously, in verse 23, he slips into prayer. He prays to the bear, to the lion, to the archer. We go from his to your. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. It's hard for him to remember these things about God and not reflexively saying them to God. Remembering the covenant faithfulness of God reminds him he can pray to this God, even as God is afflicting him. And we see the effect this has on him. Go back to verses 20 and 21. There are two kinds of thinking here. Verse 20, my soul continually remembers it, that is my affliction and my wanderings, and is bowed down within me. When he thinks about his afflictions, it brings about a deep depression. I remember these things continually, and I'm bowed down. My soul is bowed down within me. But, verse 21, this other thing I call to mind. There's something else I think about. And therefore I have hope. When he recalls the love and faithfulness, the covenant commitment of God, he has hope. And it's a reminder to us that what we think about matters. What he thinks about has consequences. As he thinks about his own affliction and his own misery, it increases his misery. As he thinks about God's love and faithfulness, it leads to hope. But notice too that verse 20, that reflecting and remembering of his affliction seems to be involuntary. I just do it continually. I don't have to do anything for that to happen. It's just automatic. But in verse 21, I have to call to mind what God is like. That involves an act of the will, a deliberate effort. It won't happen otherwise. I've got to make myself think about this. And again, it is the same for us. We need to call to mind, that's a discipline, the covenant faithfulness of God. In context of our own affliction, we have to call to mind, to make ourselves think about and remember the covenant by which God has bound himself to us. The new covenant. If we go through times of hardship, we need our Christian friends around us to pray that we would be able to remember the covenant God has made, his faithfulness to it, the blood of Jesus poured out for us. When we go through affliction, we need to be taking the Lord's Supper. Again, one of the great means God has given us of calling this covenant to mind. So that we have hope. And verse 23, it needs to be appropriated every single morning. There is not a day of your life where you do not need to recall the mercy of God. And to receive it afresh. Having a spectacular quiet time today doesn't mean you can take tomorrow off. You know, that's such a feed, I'm not going to need anything for another few days now. No, every morning we can taste afresh the mercy of God. And so every morning we need to call to mind so that we have hope. And it won't happen if we don't do it. We won't drift into thinking about God's faithfulness. We need to call it to mind. And wonderfully, there isn't a morning of our life where we can't do that. There's no morning when a realization of God's mercy is unavailable to us. Well, as we finish up, how does he apply that hope? How does he respond to it? Well, we look at verses 25 and following. Now, these next three lines don't just start with the same letter. They start with the same word. Verses 25, 26 and 27 each begin with the word good. Three things are good. God is good. Verse 25, to those who wait for him. It's amazing that the God of verses 1 to 18, the God who's been savaging him, shooting at him, tearing him apart, is also the God who is good. Those things are both true at the same time. Christopher Wright says in his book on this, if the God who punishes is the God who is good, then punishment cannot be the last word. There must be a future worth waiting for. God is good to those who wait for him. He knows he has something to wait for. If God is the God of covenant faithfulness, then this affliction cannot be the end of the story. And therefore, verse 26, waiting is good. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It doesn't mean I should never speak and I shouldn't have just said all the things I've just said in this chapter. That sense of quiet trust, of calm before the Lord. And verse 27, also good, is learning some of these things when you are younger. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth, the yoke being the discipline of God. The earlier we learn the discipline of the Lord, the better it will be for us. So we shouldn't resent those times the Lord disciplines us. We shouldn't be longing for just an easy life of things. It is actually a mercy of God when we go through trials in our youth. Well, he continues and he unpacks more about the kind of proper attitude to this chastisement that comes from the Lord. But I want to finish by looking at verses 31 to 33 that close off this section. We come now to the reason why this man, in the midst of this utter affliction, is yet able to wait and trust and hope. And again, each line in verses 31 to 33 doesn't just start with the same letter. It starts with the same word, and the word this time is because. So we have three big becauses that show us why this man can have hope in God. What is the bedrock foundation of his hope? This is what accounts for how he can go through the suffering and yet have a steady trust in God. Because, verse 31, the Lord will not cast off forever. He is casting off, but it won't be forever. Verse 32, because though he causes grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love. Yes, I'm in grief. He's causing me grief, but he will have compassion. Because, verse 33, he does not willingly afflict or grieve the children of men. He does bring affliction, but it's not what he's about. And friends, this is key. I don't know what translation you've got. In mine it says, he does not willingly afflict. It literally means this affliction is not from his heart. He's doing it. He's afflicting. He means to do it. But it's not where his heart is. We've just been reminded that what is central to God is his compassion and faithfulness. His judgment and his anger are real, but they're not symmetrical to his love and his faithfulness. Christopher Wright points out, we can say God is love in a way that we can't say God is anger. The two are not equal and opposite. They're not symmetrical. One is primary. God is slow to anger, but trigger happy when it comes to love. And so it is that Isaiah can describe God's judgment as his strange work. I can't remember which theologian described it as God's left-handed work. It's not the thing that comes most naturally to him, if you like. And therefore it reminds us of what is just being confessed and affirmed in verses 22 to 24. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. You will know if you use social media that you can have a pinned post, right? If you're on Twitter or something, there's a post that is particularly important. You want people to always see that post first. You can pin it, so it's always at the top of your feed. If someone looks at your profile, no matter what else you're rabbiting on about, that bit always comes first. Yeah? Theologically, the love and faithfulness of God are his pinned doctrines. That confession from Exodus, that he is, I've forgotten the words of it, let me look it up. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. God has pinned that. That is his pinned post. That is at the top of his profile. That is the banner hanging over everything else God is and does. It does not deny the reality of the pain and suffering. Those things have not gone away. The Lord is causing grief. The Lord is afflicting. The Lord is casting off. But it reminds him that those things are not ultimate. And therefore they need to be looked at in the context of what is ultimate about God. We don't have to pretend they don't exist. In the rest of the chapter, he's going to return to the most overwhelming despair. Verse 49, my eyes will flow without ceasing, without respite. This doesn't fix everything. But we do need to know it. Best advice I have ever been given as a Christian is this. Deal with what you don't know in the context of what you do know. Or as the hymn puts it for us, I cannot tell, but this I know. And it is by recalling to mind what we are sure of, what we do know, that we can have hope in the midst of even the most horrific affliction. I'm going to close there. We've got 5 minutes. Does anyone want to make a comment, ask a question, reflect on any of this?